This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
So I wanted to talk tonight on the topic of self-compassion and how we can hold a place of compassion for ourselves no matter what is arising. And this is a topic that I just am really profoundly interested in and care about so much, because I think we live in a culture, and it's hard to say because there are multiple cultures in the room, but much of the dominant U.S. culture is one of great self-judgment, self-criticism, self-hatred, lots of self-hatred. And it's kind of an epidemic. It's an epidemic that we're facing, where people struggle with self-doubt, self-blame, self-judgment, and it's all over. And it comes from, you know, it comes from all sorts of things. We're probably living at the epicenter of it right here in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, wonderful.
And certainly the media influences it, and all the ways that we're supposed to look, or we're supposed to be, or how successful we're supposed to be, or what we're supposed to have accomplished by now, or our weight, or our size, or whatever it is. This is, you know, the media influences, our family, how we grew up, our peers. But it's really, it's a struggle that so many of us deal with. And I know it's epidemic, because I'll just read you a little, it's kind of silly, but it's an Oprah interview with Meryl Streep, where Oprah says, Meryl, actually they're talking about movies, and basically Meryl Streep says she's doesn't like to be in a movie because she feels like she's terrible. And Oprah says, Meryl, why have you tried to back out? And Meryl says, because I say to myself, I don't know how to act. Why does anyone want to look at me on the screen anymore? This is Meryl Streep, people. Okay. So she says, Meryl Streep thinks she can't act. And Meryl says, lots of actors feel that way. What gives you strength is also your weakness, your raging insecurity. And then she says, but somewhere inside you, don't you know that you're the gold standard? And she says, yeah, but does that help? So evidently this was also with Julianne Moore and Nicole Kidman. And she says, Julianne, I've heard from your agent that after every film, you're sure you'll never work again. And Julianne says, at the beginning of a movie, I'm scared. By the middle, I'm doubting my choices. And by the end, I'm certain I've ruined the film. Sometimes I'll even suggest other actors for the parts I'm offered. And Nicole says, I do that, I suggested you. And Julianne says, I suggested you, and they do this whole thing. So it's pretty bad when the leading actresses of our time feel like they can't act. This culture of comparing, of blaming, of shaming, of I'm not good enough, it's really inherent. And I'm just curious if people are willing to just say out loud a self-critical voice that they might have. Yeah.
It's always not good enough.
It's always not good enough.
I hate myself.
I hate myself, yeah.
I have everything and I'm miserable.
I have everything and I'm miserable.
Well, my self-voice has changed dramatically through the years. However, I am very strongly governed and influenced by others' critical voices. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily what they say, but it's what they don't say which reveals who they really are. And that really, unfortunately, the way I navigate, that's very influential. It really pisses me off.
Yeah, so it can be very frustrating and difficult to both when people come at you with criticism, and also just the feeling that we get from other people sometimes. So let me actually, that's a good lead into this, Harry, and we do something about the way we compare with each other. Marie is doing Alice's hair when along comes Tanya, a mutual acquaintance. Tanya has the perfect life, great body, well-behaved children, primo social status. Watching her walk by, Alice admires her beauty, then relaxes into the pleasant sensation of Marie's hand arranging her hair. Marie, by contrast, nearly explodes with jealousy and competitiveness. Her teeth and stomach clench as she watches Tanya flaunt her long limbs, thick hair, and most enviable of all, her rose-red rump. Tanya and Marie and Alice are baboons.
Social primates who share around 95% of our DNA and a lot of our psychological traits. Scientists have found that some baboons, like Marie, are extremely competitive, while others, like Alice, are more mellow, less worried about measuring up. The more rank-conscious baboons suffer higher blood pressure, a stress-related condition we associate with driven, competitive humans. So that's kind of disturbing. But the thing that also is interesting to know is when it starts to feel like maybe this is wired into us genetically, that it's not our fault if we're competitive and comparing and judging and we always come out negatively, because it's in us, it's in, there's something, and I'm sure it has to do with status and different drives and, you know, and keep taking care of the children and, you know, infants and so forth. But so we have these voices inside our head, these voices that criticize ourselves, that judge ourselves. And, you know, if we were, well, we would never let somebody else be as mean to ourselves as we are to ourselves, right? We just wouldn't let someone get away with it. But we let ourselves do it all day long. We can have a whole array of voices in our head. You failed, you screwed up, why'd you do that again, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of us really, really want to be perfect. Raise your hand if you at times wished you were perfect. Yeah. Yeah, or maybe all the time.
Actually, I wish I could be me completely.
So, and I do want to distinguish, I want to take a moment, because this judging mind that judges, I want to distinguish it from what we might call discernment. Because there is truth often to the ways that we judge ourselves. There's an element of truth. So if we get up in the morning and we sleep through our alarm and we realize that we really should have gotten up earlier and a voice says, oh, wow, I should have gotten up earlier, that's being discerning, that's being wise, and that's actually helping you. You can make a change based on that discernment. But if you wake up in the morning, you slept through your alarm, and you start going, I'm such a jerk, I'm so stupid, why did I sleep, I'm lazy, I'm bad, that is judging. So there's a big difference between noticing that there's something that's wrong, that, or that needs to be changed, or could be changed, and working on it, and judging yourself and all the aversion that's layered on how we treat ourselves. So I just want to be clear about that. Now, there's a woman who's doing a lot of research on self-compassion and actually defining the construct. And just to say a little bit about me, I work at, most of you know, but I work at the Mindful Awareness Research Center at UCLA, and we're very interested in the science behind mindfulness and these techniques and practices. And so I'll likely, as a teacher, I'll be weaving in some of the science because it interests me. But a woman named Kristen Neff wrote a book and did a lot of research on it called Self-Compassion, where she looked at what and defined a construct of self-compassion. And self-compassion is not self-esteem. This was in direct, it was directly in opposition to the self-esteem construct that was devised. So self-esteem, for a long time we've been really trying to teach our kids self-esteem. Okay, feel better about yourself. So that created the tyranny of good job. You know, good job. Oh, you went down the slide. Good job. You brushed your tooth. Good job. You peed. Good job. You know, it's like this endless. In hopes of bringing people more, you know, having the kids have more self-esteem. But what it created instead was a sense of my worth was based on external approval, as opposed to internal and intrinsic sense of worth. And it also led some to inflation. And by the way, just to say, if you did this to your kids or you had this done to you, don't worry. It can be healed and you didn't screw them up, because whatever I'm learning as a parent, I'm sure it's all wrong. And I'll find that out in another 20 years, but just to say that. So self-compassion is the construct of mindfulness, cultivation of heart-based qualities like loving-kindness and compassion. And the third one is a recognition of our shared humanity. So what that is you take the mindfulness to work with the critical thinking, and I'm going to go into each thing. You work with the critical thinking, the judging voices, those voices that many of you mentioned when I asked earlier. You use mindfulness to work with the thoughts. Then you cultivate a sense of greater love for yourself. And then finally, you recognize that you're doing this in the context of shared humanity, that we're not the only one who does this. So keep in mind, self-compassion is not about being perfect. Self-compassion is not about not screwing up. Self-compassion is about having resiliency and self-forgiveness. So you realize that part of being human is that you make mistakes, that you're not perfect. And that instead of beating yourself up for not being perfect, you forgive yourself and you move on and you take it and you learn from it. This is self-compassion. These are the kinds of skills we hope to be able to generate in ourselves and in our children. So let's talk a little bit about mindfulness and how mindfulness impacts this, or mindfulness or your meditation practice or Dharma practice in general. And one of the best ways that we can use mindfulness is to have a recognition and awareness of our thoughts and not get so lost in the grip of those thoughts. So that when we have these thoughts coming at us, I'm a jerk, I'm bad, I failed, I shouldn't have done that, why did I do, whatever it is, we can just notice them as thoughts themselves. And for those of you who've been sitting and meditating for a long time, I think you've seen the way our mind is this wild mind that can produce any kind of thought. It's not like I say, okay, now I'm going to think a negative thought about myself. Anyone set out to do that? Mm-hmm. Of course not. What happens is it just pops out. It just comes out into your mind, and it's based on your conditioning, it's based on your past, it's based on your history, but it's conditioned in us. So we'll have this voice that says something negative, and you know, and we believe it. That's the problem. So my favorite bumper sticker, and I'll say this in my classes, is don't believe everything you think. Have you seen that bumper sticker? I've seen it once since I moved to Los Angeles. When I lived in Berkeley, I saw it probably, I don't know, many, many times. But so the idea is not to believe everything you think. And that's not to say that thoughts are not incredible, thoughts are not powerful, that we have tremendous thoughts, and thoughts that create the entire world. You know, someone had this idea, I think I want to start a meditation center here in Santa Monica, and here we are. And here it is many years later with all these people, all this community. It was an incredible thought. It started as a thought. However, so many of our thoughts are thoughts that lead to suffering. And if you really check into yourself, it doesn't have to be necessarily self-judgment thoughts. It could be anxiety thoughts, depressed thoughts, fearful thoughts, greed thoughts. But there's just all this thinking that leads to suffering. And that's where mindfulness is so powerful. This is where mindfulness can come in and go, okay, we have something we can do right here. We can be aware. We can be aware in the midst of our thoughts. And we can do it when we're on the cushion, when we're meditating in our practice, in our daily practice, or when you come here. And you can notice the thoughts kind of coming and going. And you can bring your mindfulness to it. And that can impact your relationship to your thoughts. So sometimes I think of thoughts as like little balloons popping out of our head. You know, like in a cartoon, you have a thought balloon out of a cartoon. And so, in someone's head in a cartoon. And so mindfulness is like a pin that just pricks the balloon and it pops. And it's really amazing. Raise your hand if you've had the experience of meditating, noticing your thinking, and the thought just disappears, disintegrates. Of course, yeah. It's a fairly liberating moment when you start to see that there is a way to shift your relationship to thoughts. One of the tools that's really helpful is to label thinking. So if you're meditating and a repetitive, obsessive voice starts coming in your head, whether it's an anxious voice, a depressed voice, my friend refers to it as depressive propaganda. You know, you really believe it, you really, really believe it, or something anxious. It's all propaganda that your mind is saying to you. So just noticing it and saying, and giving it a label, judging, self-judgment, or worrying, or feeling sad, or just giving it a specific label helps you to see that thought for what it is, just a thought. And oftentimes there's an emotion connected to it, so it can be really helpful to bring your attention into your body and feel what's happening underneath. Because much of our thinking is fueled by emotion, but we're disconnected from it. So for instance, if you're having a lot of anxiety and you try to figure it out on the level of, okay, I'm going to make those thoughts stop, or I'm going to try to soothe myself with my thinking, it typically doesn't work. What does work is if we can feel our bodies in that moment. It doesn't always work, but sometimes works. And feel the feeling of our heart racing, of our stomach clenched, of our jaw tight, of whatever is going on in that moment. Because this emotion is fueling the thinking. And so it's like cutting a cycle. So for instance, if you're having a lot of judgment, you're probably having a strong internal response, a physical sensation, and then you start judging yourself more because you want to get away from it. So sometimes we're judging ourselves, and then we're judging ourselves for judging ourselves, and then judging ourselves for judging ourselves for judging ourselves, you know, and it can be really intense. And so with the practice, we can short-circuit this loop of thinking and see it just for what it is. It's kind of like a tape loop. Sorry, that's probably a really old analogy. It's kind of like a broken iPod. I don't know, what can I say? But something that just keeps replaying and replaying. Can't say broken record anymore unless, anyway. So we can begin to become aware of it. We can label it, we can feel it in our body, we can soothe ourselves and say, and we can ask a question, is this true? Do we know this to be true? Usually the answer is well, not really, I don't know, but in the moment, in the heat of the moment with this difficult thinking, we get really lost. So it's learning to treat ourselves in the way that we might treat a child. Like if a child says, God, I was so stupid, you don't say, yeah, you were really stupid. Of course not. You would say, "Wow, I hear you that you think that, and I think, and that's not the case. I see how incredibly bright you are," or whatever you want to do to counteract that. But sometimes all they just want is to be heard and understood, to be with. And it's a little bit like, well, Dr. Dan Siegel. Some of you are familiar with him. He's one of the founders of our center. So. He always talks about the way the certain kind of the parts of the brain that are being activated through meditation are the parts of the brain that are activated in secure attachment relationships. So when you're feeling the loving presence of a parent, which many of us didn't get, or the loving presence of a partner or a therapist, your brain is what's activated is the prefrontal cortex. And it helps to regulate our emotions. It's the CEO of our brain. It helps us have more regulation, more empathy, more ease, more sense of well-being. And the speculation is that's what's happening when we meditate. That we're essentially, another really layman's or laywoman's way of talking about it, is that we're learning to be our own best friend. We're learning to treat ourselves with love and compassion through the practice of mindfulness. A story that I often tell about self-judgment relates to a friend of mine who was meditating on a retreat. And she was doing this long meditation retreat, and she had so much self-judgment coming up, just day after day, self-judgment, self-judgment. And one day she was walking, doing walking meditation outside, and she saw this little chipmunk down on the street. And she looked down, and she went down closer to it to look at it, and ran away. And this voice in her head said, I'm such a bad meditator, even the chipmunks hate me. And she was feeling like, even the chipmunks hate me? Come on. Chipmunks don't hate people, right? Maybe they're afraid of people, I don't know. So she then went in to talk to her teacher, and he said, how are you doing? And he said, I'm doing terribly, even the chipmunks hate me. And he said, even the chipmunks hate me, the sky is blue. And she saw in that moment that thought was just a thought, right? That there's a thought, the sky is blue, it's pretty neutral. Most people are not affected by that. And then the thought, the chipmunks hate me, is really intense, or was for her. But by putting them together, she saw that the thought was just a thought. That's all it was, just a thought. It has a lot of weight, a lot of charge, but she could let go. She could let go. And so every time she had a negative thought towards herself after that, every time it would arise, she would notice it mindfully and say, even the chipmunks hate me, the sky is blue, just to remind herself to be more loving to herself. And so what we're aiming for, what happens as we do this meditation practice, is a kind of disidentification, not taking our thoughts and our emotions so personally. They become like clouds passing through the sky. They don't have the kind of grip that they tend to have where we get so lost and so hung up in our thoughts. And that's why it's so important for this construct of self-compassion, because we have to work on the level of what's actually happening, which is this negative thinking that's going on. And it doesn't mean trying to replace the negative thinking with positive thinking. That doesn't really work so well. It means seeing it, it's just a thought, and letting it go. So the second, well, I'm going to skip now to the third part, actually. The third part, which is the part about shared humanity. Shared humanity. We have more self-compassion when we recognize that we're not the only one, that we're not the only one who's ever screwed up. And there's a wonderful story in the Buddhist teachings about, and unfortunately I'm forgetting the name of the woman, but it was a woman who was alive at the time of the Buddha who had a series of horrible events happen to her, including the loss of her child, the death of her child. And all of these events just threw her over the edge, and she started to go crazy. And she went to the Buddha and she said, "Can you help me? Can you bring back my son?" And the Buddha said, "I will bring back your son if you can bring me a mustard seed from the home of someone who has not experienced death." So some of you know this story. So she then goes and begins knocking on door after door after door, and the door would open and she'd say, "Has anyone not experienced death in your home?" And they'd say, "No." And the next one, "Has anyone died?" And they'd say, "Yes, someone has died." And it was, and after doing this many, many times, she finally realized this truth, that she was not the only one who had experienced this horrible tragedy, but that everybody, every single person has experienced loss. And then the story goes that she went to the Buddha, that the craziness just sort of lifted, and she went to the Buddha and he ordained her, and she became a nun under him and reached these high stages of enlightenment. And it's pretty amazing this happened. So for us, I wanted to do just a little exercise about this to kind of prove my point here. And this exercise, I'm going to ask you to in a moment, to stand up. And this is good because you've been sitting for a while, so I'll give you a little exercise. To stand up if any of these things apply to you, okay? So stand up if you've ever compared yourself to others. And by the way, if you can't keep standing up, you just take care of yourself. So, all right, come back down. Next question. Stand up if you've ever done something stupid.
That's a matter of opinion.
Yes, it's a matter of opinion, but you can make your own opinion. Okay. Back down. Stand up if you've ever felt inadequate and not up to an important task. And just look around as you do this. I just want you to see what's happening in the room. Okay. Back down. Stand up if you have ever looked in the mirror and not liked what you saw.
Oh, I like that.
Come back down.
I love the way I look now that I'm older.
Okay. Some people you get better at
that's
more,
right.
More compassionate over time. Stand up. I know if you wanted to stay standing, you could do that too. Stand up if you've ever not achieved something you wish you had.
Oh,
yeah. Look around. Okay. Back down.
Well, we're good company.
Yeah. Stand up if you've ever screwed up something that was really important.
Oh.
How about hurt someone you love? Been hurt by someone you love. You can just stay standing. Lost something or someone important to you. Felt you were alone and thought you were the only one. Yeah. Let's look around the room one last time. That pretty much everybody's standing. And maybe just send silent compassion to all of us. Just wishing everyone well. And knowing that you're not alone. And then can slowly come back down. And you can notice, you can just take a moment to notice what's happening inside you having done this. And we did it in a playful way, but It's true. When part of the hardest thing about feeling that you are inadequate or not up to something is that you think you're the only one, and that is so not true. And so, just a reminder, that's the part of this self-compassion, just a reminder. So let's move to the third piece, which is the piece of cultivating more states of love and kindness and compassion for ourselves. And so, I know for myself that doing the loving kindness practice over an extended period of time was absolutely transformational. How many of you have spent, like, devoted energy to the loving kindness practice over time? Yeah, that's great. I had a period of time in my life where I was, I had left a nonprofit, which I'd been working at for many years, and I was so burned out, just completely exhausted. And I went on a retreat, and I decided to send loving kindness, metta, to myself. And I was going to do it to myself. And typically the way you do it is you start with yourself, and then you start with the easiest person, a benefactor. And then you send it to yourself, and you send it to loved ones, and then to neutral people, out to difficult people, and then out in many directions. And I was doing it, and I was doing it to myself. And I basically got stuck there. Not really stuck, I stayed there. I stayed there for a month, sending loving kindness to myself every single day for a month. Every single second, not every single day, every single second. Practicing it, and it was probably one of the most healing things I've ever done. It transformed the burnout. It brought myself home to myself. It was so powerful, and what would happen was I would send it to myself, and after a while, I would come up against the ways that I couldn't love myself. So I'd be sending it, and then this voice would say, yeah, right. Or another voice would say, yeah, but remember when you did this. And then I have to work on forgiveness for myself. Or then I have to work on opening my heart more deeply. And so what I love about the loving kindness practice, if you're new, it's a deceptively simple practice of saying phrases and sending words and feelings of kindness to yourself or others. Or it can have different flavors. It can be more of a compassion practice or more of a joy practice. And so you say these phrases. But what happens is you get to see what gets in the way of being able to love. And when that happens, you have to sit with that. You really have to show up for yourself. So let's say you're doing it and you start to feel all this jealousy or comparing mind. Then you can bring your mindfulness to it. You can stop the loving kindness practice and turn your attention to the mindfulness. And what is the jealousy like? How am I feeling it in my body? What are these thoughts that are happening? All of the things I was talking about earlier with the working with difficult thoughts. So sometimes people think that if you were just to send loving kindness to yourself or compassion to yourself, it would be very, very narcissistic or something. Like, you shouldn't do that because what about everybody else? There's so much suffering on the planet. We have to send it out. And I love this. There's a beautiful quote from Bell Hooks, the feminist theorist, who says, "When I talked with friends and acquaintances about self-love, I was surprised to see how many of us feel troubled by the notion, as though the very idea implies too much narcissism or selfishness. We all need to rid ourselves once and for all of misguided notions about self-love. We need to stop fearfully equating it with self-centeredness and selfishness. Self-love is the foundation of our loving practice. Without it, our other efforts to love fail. Self-love is the foundation of our loving practice. Without it, our other efforts to love fail." And it's very much aligned with the beautiful quote of the Buddha, which says you can search the whole world over and find no one more worthy of love than yourself. Just as a mother protects with her life, her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart, may I cherish all living beings, and that includes herself. So this cultivation of this practice and of more kindness for ourselves, it's kind of like, I like to think of it like, You're doing some healing work from the top down with the mindfulness. You're really working on all those negative thinking. And by the way, people change. I just want to put that out. People really change. I have watched thousands of people over the years, worked with them, and I have seen people transform from being self-judgmental, self-critical, to being more accepting and kind. But it takes a lot of work. So it takes some of the work of the mindfulness practice and then the loving kindness practice. So I think of that kind of as top down, and then I think of the loving kindness practice as kind of bottom up. Like we're changing the very ground of our being so that more love is coming in and more love is flowing into ourselves, and we can accept that we're okay. So sometimes it starts out really small. It's just like, I'm okay, as opposed to I love myself. And I know people get triggered. Oh no, it can sound kind of, oh, like I don't know, woo-woo or something, like sending love to ourselves. But the fact is, it's a healing balm for our times. We need to find ways of being more compassionate and caring. And I will say, looking at my own journey over, you know, a long time, I come into more places of self-love, and then other things reveal themselves. So I'm more loving, I'm more kind, and more compassionate, and then there's this new place that opens up for me, and it's like, great, now I have a new place to work. It used to be like when a new place arose, I would think, oh no, I thought I was over this. And aren't I supposed to be better by now? Aren't I supposed to be fixed? Now I look at this and I go, oh, how exciting. A new thing to explore, to bring kindness to, a new area in my life. How wonderful, what a gift. So, I always think that those are the three aspects of this practice, of the development of self-compassion. And I want to add a fourth piece, because I think that there's another piece that's not talked about. And one way of talking about is talking about our Buddha nature. And I'm wondering, in this sangha, does the term Buddha nature get used?
Not really.
Not really? Is it okay for me to use it?
Probably.
All right. It's not exactly, I mean, Noah is very rooted in the Theravada tradition, and it's not exactly from Theravada, but I think you will see it in Theravada. And Buddha nature is the concept of one's own inner goodness, inner sense of well-being, inner enlightened mind, inner awakened mind. And this concept, which I sometimes simply translate as our own inner goodness, that this is actually the true nature of who we are. We think we're our anxiety. We think we're our screw-ups. We think we are our depression. But actually, that's just part of the passing show. Real thing, what's really going on is who we are inside is something so much vaster than that, something so much more profound. And it's that place of freedom that we can access, that we've had tastes. You've had tastes when you meditated.
Yep.
You've had tastes out in your life. You've had tastes in a moment when you're deeply, deeply connected with another person, or you're in nature and you feel absolutely at home and at peace. Our Buddha nature is within us, and if we look at the self-judgment, self-criticism as coming from a place of lack, like there's something wrong with me and now I have to get better, we're just in trouble, because then it's a self-improvement project. But if we look at it instead as we are already inherently whole, that we're inherently good, and our true nature is joyous and compassionate and peaceful and at ease and humorous, and connected, then all it's about removing the clouds that get in the way, that we get identified with, so we can see the vast, radiant sun behind it. And that's our job. That's really our job. At least that's how I see it. So, I think what I'll do is I'll stop, and I'll see if there are any questions based on what I just said. We can take some time. Yeah.
Thank you. For me, I mean, it's been difficult to get past that the fakeness I know. I mean, I don't stay with it long enough to allow the fakeness to pass and the, yeah. you know, the loving kindness to come. So.
Okay. So he's talking about the feeling of fakeness when you do the practice of loving kindness.
Yeah, I'd be happy that I'd be fake.
Yeah.
I don't believe in anyone. So. I mean,
so you're not the only one.
Okay.
Okay. Anybody else have a hard time with the loving kindness practice? Okay. Look around. Shared humanity. Yeah, yeah. It's not an easy practice, and I want to confess right here that I didn't like it for the first probably decade of my practice. Yep. True confessions. I didn't like it. I had the same feeling. It felt fake, kind of weird to me, stupid. Why was I doing it? And the mindfulness practice was so compelling, so interesting, so that my mind just wanted to go there. And I look back now and I just think, oh, I wasn't ready for it, and it's fine. I'm gonna answer this in two ways. I'm gonna say, one, keep trying, because oftentimes it shifts and you do have to give it time. So if you're really interested in developing it, you need to devote more than like 10 minutes to it a day or whatever it is, or 5 minutes. You need to let it move through that space of difficulty. And for me, that turnaround happened when I told you about that retreat where I did it every day. And I just felt like I was bathing in it and I wanted to do it. Now, the mindfulness practice in and of itself has so much of the compassion side to it too. So it's not like there's two practices and one is all about love and the other is all about awareness. Sometimes we can think that. When I first started my meditation practice, I was like, oh, Vipassana, it's so dry. I need to go find a guru so I can have a lot of the juicy practice. So I traveled all around India looking for my guru and I never found them. And then I realized that it was right there in the practice itself. There is acceptance, there is that cultivation of it. And there's another practice that is really valuable. So I would say, honor the fact that it's hard for you and just let yourself be okay with it. Give it a little try now and then and see what happens. And then at some point you may make a choice to really dive into it and trust your own timing. That's how I see it, okay? Yeah, no pushing, no need to push.
Yeah, this is more of a statement, and I could pretty much answer this for myself, but it's just more of like a frustration, because the way I tend to try to intellectualize it, based on a lot of documentaries and reading, gnashing through many books, is a lot of these thoughts, they're really not mine. I mean, I've like conditioned to them, and I identify with them now, and I call them mine, but really, they're not. But the reality is, I am identified, and my sense of self is from these thoughts. But really, the etymology of where they really originated from is just like a made-up social story that has no basis of reality at all. And yeah, it's attractive to be able to walk away from this freaking society and go up into the mountains and meditate like the Buddha. But that's impractical. I'm bound by materialism and the comforts, and I'm an active participant in the world. So as much as I try to, you know, disassociate, I get caught up in a contradiction, because I'm a participant in society. So I just automatically, without thinking, I mean, just reflexively plug right into the madness. And it's like, I'd like to disassociate it with completely, to really get in touch with what's up with me. But it seems it's such a between a rock and a hard spot. It's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, so let me just say a couple of things. I mean, I think you were pointing to what I was saying earlier about the way that our thoughts come unbidden. Like, we didn't decide, I'm going to think these negative thoughts about ourselves. They just do, right? So they come. Just in the same way our heart pumps blood, our mind thinks thoughts. So knowing that can be a really helpful thing, especially in the midst of this world that we live in that can be very compelling. We can get really sucked in, and we can also say, oh, that was a thought. So we can use our practice every day. This is not just for sitting on the cushion. If this practice were just about sitting on the cushion, it would be a nice thing to do. But it's being able to take it out into the world and to be aware of our thinking in every moment. And there's a lovely little concept that I like... being, let's see if I can remember it, being in the world, but not of the world. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that speaks to what you're asking for. Like, how do you really, you're in the world, and you really do, or is that it? Being of the, yes, I got it right? Now I'm losing my propositions here. But we're fully living our life, but we're not sucked in to the madness in a way that you're pointing to. And I think that it's doable. It really is doable with these practices. Yes?
To add to that, Eckhart Tolle, this is one of my favorite quotes. He said, you have to find the life outside your life circumstance.
Yeah. That's beautiful. She said, you have to find the life, from Eckhart Tolle, you have to find the life outside your life circumstance.
Like detached involvement.
There you go.
Yeah.
One of Ajahn Amaro, who I know Noah loves, he often calls, refers to it as disentangled participation. Mm-hmm. Heard that? You're in it, but you're not hooked into it.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.